interest. There's more like lectures coming up. There's one on Friday by Alex Wells III, and also one on Monday by Hoi Kwon. Other thing is that I'm not doing Paikudos anymore. It's passing over to Carlos Marchand there, taking care from now on. Okay, and for today I'd like to introduce Steve Flamier from the University of New Mexico. Good, it's still Saturday.
Friday
is still Friday. And he's going to tell us three tales.
Two tales. Some more interesting things came up, so I decided I'd focus a little bit more on the third of the tales and cut out the second one entirely. And so I've been busy completely redoing my talk as a result, and so I haven't actually gone through this talk myself yet, so it's going to be a little rough around the edges, and I apologize for that, but hopefully we can make up for that by making it a bit more of a dialogue. You guys can stop me, ask questions, and be a good audience. Okay, so in fact, I'm going to change the title entirely from Two Tales, we'll just erase that, to Entanglement. What is it good for? Okay? And so, just to build on that a little bit, you know, okay, generic opening sentence, you know, of course we want to understand the role of entanglement in quantum information. It's a necessary, but it's not a sufficient condition. And as examples of that, there's this result by Joseph and Linden, which shows that if your entanglement is blocked up in sufficiently small blocks, you know, they can scale, but they have to be in something small. Then you can simulate it classically. And so you need to have some notion of global entanglement if you're going to expect to get, I believe this is for an exponential speed up. But then there are other results, such as the Gottesman-Knill theorem, which say that, hey, there are certain situations where a whole bunch of entanglement isn't going to buy you anything. You can simulate it classically. So, you know, when does entanglement buy you something and when doesn't it? We don't really know the answer to that question, although it's under active investigation. And so I'm going to contrast two systems here. One called the power of one qubit, sometimes called DQC1. And if anybody here knows their Latin, the motto for this is multum ex parvo, a lot out of a little. And quantum metrology, parvo ex multum, a little bit out of a lot of entanglement. And so the first one I'm going to talk about is the power of one qubit. So this is a computational model due to Knill and LaPlante. This is the original reference. There have been a series of other papers following up on it. But here's the basic idea. We have an initial state, which in the case that alpha equals 1, alpha is a polarization here on the first qubit. In the case that alpha equals 1, we have a pure initial state here in the first register. And then we have n qubits in a totally mixed state, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to do a controlled unitary after Hadamarding the first qubit, and then we're going to measure in some basis, okay? So this is called the power of one qubit, or DQC1. So what can this computational model do? Well, if u is the unitary operator, here's a problem which we'd like to solve. Let u be a unitary operator on n qubits. Assume that we can efficiently decompose this unitary in terms of some elementary gates, right? This is actually not a small assumption. Most unitaries don't have such an efficient decomposition. But we'd like to estimate this sort of normalized trace of u up to some fixed accuracy epsilon, which I didn't put the epsilon in. So this sounds like a bit of an artificial problem. In fact, it has applications. I didn't list the references. You can do a forward literature search on this paper. Anyone's work I forgot to list. You can test the integrability of chaotic systems, and you can estimate density of states if you can solve this problem efficiently. So how does this, let's delve into this circuit a little bit. There's the density operator. I have a U and a U. The U and U dagger here should be switched, but that doesn't make any difference to my results here. This is the output state here on the right. It looks like this. And that's where the green arrow is here. And then we're going to measure in some basis. Okay, if we measure sigma x there at the end of that circuit, then we get the real part of the trace. And if we measure sigma y, then we get the imaginary part. Okay? And you know, measuring this one qubit, this is efficient for all alpha. Alpha is the polarization. Fixed there are epsilon. And for all n, we just need to do this many measurements in order to do this. Okay? So there's a few possibilities here. Either there's an efficient classical algorithm for it, or there's not, right? And I'm going to posit this. This has been conjectured previously, but nobody knows this, so I put this in yellow. That might not turn out to be true. And then there's sort of entanglement-wise, there's two possibilities here as well. The state of the computer could be separable during the computation, okay? Or it could be entangled. And we're gonna see that it is in fact globally entangled. That's what I'm gonna show you. It would be very surprising indeed if both this and this first one were true, then we would have an exponential speed up in separable states. Yes?
So you think about this is an efficient algorithm for computing this trace?
The normalized trace to a fixed accuracy, yeah.
And now in the quantum case, you're actually given the unitary operation.
I'm also assuming that you have an efficient decomposition in terms of some elementary gate set.
So it's like a promise problem, given the description of the unitary.
Yeah, that's right.
So why would it be so shocking if the state was separable if it's a mixed state?
Because
there's no general simulation of where separable mixed state computation.
Probably isn't.
Fair enough, but it runs counter to my intuition that we would be able to achieve exponential speedups with separable states. Maybe that's not a universal intuition, but that's an intuitive statement.
Did
Carl and Rudiger Schacht try to show that essentially?
Okay, the Kayes and Schacht result. If I understand it correctly, is they have a local hidden variable model for NMR quantum computing that mocks up the correlations in a certain way. I don't know exactly how that scales, though. I don't know the answer to your question.
It doesn't scale polynomially.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly. It scales exponentially, and maybe in time rather than in qubits, something like that.
Basically, the only thing we know how to do with separable mixed states is like hug exponentially close to the maximum mixed state, right? Where you know you're separable. We don't have any candidate problem or anything else.
Yeah. And in fact, I don't think I actually mentioned this in here, but, let me go back. Let me go forward again, actually. So in order to get to within a set of states that we know are separable, like, for example, inside the maximal separable ball, the radius of the maximal separable ball decreases exponentially, right? That was shown by Barnum and Gurvitz. And so we would have to, in order to stay within that, this would have to then scale with n. And in fact, you would pick up an exponential factor if you were going to achieve speed up with guaranteed separable states. There might be other candidate regions. Well, no, that is the max. Well, yeah, I mean, it's the maximum separable ball. There could be other places.
Separable states outside that ball.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I can't rule out getting speed ups in those regions, but you know, it's at least consistent with the notion that it's going to be, you're not going to get a speed up with separable states.
Suppose that even you're not separable, but how much entanglement would you have at a state which is so near in
I don't know.
We call it the power of one qubit because of exactly that, because you're encoding mixed.
Right.
I have a little bit of entanglement.
Right. Well, that's exactly what I'm about to do next, is I'm going to I'm going to bound the amount of entanglement in this, and I'm going to show that it's actually a constant. So, okay, let's do that right now. So where's the entanglement? Okay, well, it's pretty easy to show that if I consider this, I'm only going to consider bipartite entanglement in this talk. But if we consider the following bipartite split right here, which is sort of the one that jumps out at you, that in fact you can just a simple argument by diagonalizing the unitary shows that this first qubit is separable with the rest during the computation. And if you trace it out, you get a completely mixed state, right? That's unsurprising. But if we pick a different bipartite split, for example, if we split off this last qubit here from all the rest, I can, you know, a very simple choice of unitary, for example, this one here, has a negativity which is non-zero, right? So recall the negativity is just the sum of the negative eigenvalues of the partial transpose, right? And it's an entangled monotone. So non-zero negativity implies entangled state. So here's a certificate, if you will, that this is in fact entangled. Okay? So when we first did this, we found that no matter what U we chose, we could never get it above 0.25. Right? So that answers your question. There's just not a lot of entanglement here.
And if you would take a different alpha, 1/8.
Well, yeah, it goes to zero, but that's not a proof that it's separable. So you would have to.
Well, it could be in the ball.
Yeah, if alpha is small enough for fixed n, then you would eventually get to the ball within the maximal separable ball. That's right. Okay. So what we did next, we investigated pseudorandom unitaries to see how their negativity scaled. And to do this, we use this nice construction here by Emerson et al. And what we do is, at every stage, we're going to alternate between a random SU2 chosen independently on each qubit and at each stage. And then in between, we have this mixing matrix here of nearest neighbor couplings. Okay, and the nice thing about this is it very quickly approaches a random unitary, a unitary chosen from the Haar measure.
So it's proven that it quickly mixes?
Well, depends what you mean by quickly. for up to about 10 qubits, I think the scaling is still exponential. But for up to about 10 qubits, if I have about 40 iterations, then it simulates it to.
Right, because the number of degrees of freedom at each stage is on a common
It's exponential number of qubits, but the fidelity to the Haar measure is increases exponentially to 1 with the number of iterations.
That's right.
All right.
Okay, so we did this, and here it is as a function of the bipartite splitting. So, so if this is the, I'm inputting the maximally mixed state here, and I'm controlling on all these guys here, the bipartite splitting number is just, this is bipartite splitting number 1. If I split here, that's 2, and so on, all the way up. So, so we see that there's global entanglement, and no surprise, it peaks when the bipartite splitting number is, about halfway through the total number of qubits that you're inputting into this circuit. Right here, we did it up to 8 qubits here. We did it up to 9 qubits, but if you go up one more, then you reach that separable region that I mentioned. And we also split it between the last qubit and all the rest. And those two slides got switched somehow. But that's okay. Here it is as a function of the number of qubits, and it starts to level off. And so this is when we started thinking, well, maybe we can't actually get a negativity greater than 1/4. In fact, we know that there's nothing that goes out, that you're not going to get a lot of negativity out of the tails of that distribution either, because here's the standard deviation in that negativity on those random unitaries, and this is a log plot this is decreasing exponentially. So this is the exponential fidelity that Daniel just mentioned. Almost every unitary has the same negativity in this circuit. So you're not gonna, you know, it's gonna be very hard to find something that's far away from those values that I showed on the previous graphs. So what we did instead was we came up with an analytic argument to bound the negativity. So we choose an arbitrary, okay, this is important, we have an arbitrary bipartite splitting, and then we take the partial transpose, okay? I'm just gonna denote this by U cut, because it doesn't actually depend on any choice of system B here, okay? And then we're gonna find trace invariance, that is things of this form for integer S, and then we're gonna use those as constraints on the eigenvalues and do a Lagrange multiplier problem, okay? So we're gonna maximize the negativity subject to these constraints. So why am I switching the notation on the partial transpose? Well, this is, you know, you can't have nested exponents. It's just ugly and unwieldy. Nobody likes that. And, you know, all the familiar decorations have already been taken. And so, you know, my co-authors and I had thought about this choice of notation, but we decided that that looked too much like angry eyebrows. And so, you know, nobody likes to be, you know, burninated. So we went with this, which looks more like a smiley face. And here's the Bohr model. Yeah.
To me, it looks like an Eastern European mixed state.
Well, yeah, as opposed to the Turkish Ottoman state. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. Okay. All right. So how does this work? So we can write the state, so we define this matrix C, which just contains the unitary portion. The cut here just means the partial transpose on these U's. And then we can write out the trace now, just using, I mean, the identity commutes with this, so we can just use the binomial theorem to expand this out like that. And so when K is R, this thing is blocked off diagonal, and the trace vanishes, so we can do it. And in fact, for the even case, there's this nice little lemma here that if I have the trace of the product of two things which are partial transposed with respect to the same subsystem decomposition, then I can just erase the partial transposition. Right? That's a cute little theorem, easy to prove, just write it out. Okay, and so you work this out, and this doesn't extend to, you know, if I put a C or a D here, you know, this lemma doesn't hold anymore. So when K is greater than or equal to 4, we can't use this approach of these trace power constraints to bound the spectrum here. For 3 it holds because of the fact that C cubed is blocked off diagonal, and so this term. So this binomial expansion here only has even terms in the, and so you kind of trivially get all the odd ones. But the higher odd terms couple back to the lower even terms, and so you can't get 5, 7, etc. It sort of stops at 4. So, so these are our constraints then, is, you know, write this out for S equals 1, 2, and 3. Okay? And this is just, I'm picking off the even ones here by putting in the alternating sign here and an extra power of 2 here, or an extra factor of 2. Okay? And here's the negativity constraint. We want to maximize this subject to these constraints. Right? So we use Lagrange multipliers. And the symmetry of these equations makes it tractable. If you add the second constraint only, the first constraint and the second constraint, together with normalization of the density operator, that's an exactly soluble problem. We solved that exactly. However, with the cubic constraint, you get this system of constraints, which is kind of like there's like a Vandermonde matrix hidden in here. There's a lot of symmetry here, but we couldn't figure out an analytic way to solve it. A, B, and C are eigenvalues. When you when you write out these constraints, you find that the spectrum is degenerate, threefold degenerate, and these are the degeneracies, U, V, and W. Okay, and so the constraints boil down to this system of polynomial equations, okay? Which is, you know, a sixth order system, so it's not, you know, there's no simple solution. Okay, so the full constraint thing is hard to solve. The two constraint problem, though, we have an exact solution, and it's right here. It's this asymptote. For the three constraints, we have this, which is a mixture of analytic and numeric calculations. And we saturate the bound here for, what is it, 3 qubits. So we suspect that this is the best known U, but we have this nice, this is just root 2, by the way. We have this nice upper bound that shows that, hey, there's just not a lot of entanglement here. So it's pretty surprising that that it might admit an exponential speedup. And so this is why it's multum ex parvo, right? Yeah, and I already said that. Okay. So now I'm going to move on to...
Sorry, I lost track of what exactly you calculated there. This is splitting between 50% of the qubits? The bound on. What kind of division are you making with the qubits?
Oh, yeah, I guess I didn't have that, did I? Yeah, this is splitting across 50%.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. Sorry. Here, so this bound is independent of the split, right? And the reason it's independent of the splitting is this lemma. As long as I use the same splitting here, right? So when I'm taking powers, you know, rho cup squared, it's rho cup times rho cup, it's the same splitting. I use this and it eliminates the dependence on the splitting. So this is a nice little trick to eliminate. You can come up with bounds for things that are independent of the splitting. And so the actual bounds are independent of the splitting. What threw me off a little bit was that these things here, the results for the random unitaries, they do depend on the splitting because we don't have analytic results for that. Okay, so all this up here is totally independent. Okay, so now phase two, and these are, you know, fresh out of the kitchen results.
That's a good question. You're proving bounds on the negativity?
That's right.
And how does that pertain to the issue about entanglement? What's the relationship?
Well, the negativity is an entanglement monotone. So, I mean, it's one way to characterize entanglement in a system.
Right, I mean, it seems like the real question here is what is the right measure of entanglement?
Well, that's an open question, right? I mean, there is no right notion of entanglement that holds for all systems, and this one was just, I mean, you kind of pick something expedient and you run with it, and we were able to get these nice bounds. So, I mean, maybe someone else, I mean, perhaps there are theoretical results which might prevent this, but, you know, it's not, to my knowledge, logically impossible that someone could come up with another entanglement monotone for which this thing does have increasing entanglement. I don't know if that's ruled out, but for this particular one, which is a very common one because it's efficiently calculable for mixed states, it's bounded above by a constant.
But does it apply some constant bound of the amount of entanglement?
To my knowledge, the only bounds that it implies on the entanglement formation and other such things are lower bounds. There are techniques to do constraint optimization on, for example, the entanglement formation, but they always give lower bounds.
But it is a bound on the distillable.
Yeah, it's a bound on the distillable.
Upper bound.
Upper bound. Yeah, you can't get a lot of entanglement out of this.
Okay.
Right, which is intuitive, right? I mean, there's only one pure qubit there. Okay. Any other questions?
But it doesn't seem intuitively clear that the entanglement of formation should be small. Maybe that could be a lot larger.
Yeah. Yeah, it could. Yeah.
That would be a good question.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, like, explain why it's not easy to submit these things.
Well, you know, it would point, yeah, it would be in the same direction.
Yeah, so maybe it would be interesting to use those results where you use the negativity, the fixed negativity as a constraint, and try and optimize the environmental formation, because yeah, it's an interesting open problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Just a comment. So is negativity asymptotically continuous?
You mean, does it match up with the entanglement of formation? What do you mean by asymptotically continuous?
By some of these sort of formal requirements. Mm-hmm. So it means if you take the regularized version of it, so one over n with a tensor product, then copies and take the limit,
mm-hmm.
That should be a continuous function of rho.
Oh,
yeah, I think it is. Because
it's
partial transpose is just, you know, on n copies is just a tensor product.
Yeah.
Then it just follows from the Horodecki theorem that it's from the number bands divided by the distinguishable and.
Yeah, that's right. But you want an upper bound on the entanglement information, not a lower bound.
Well, it would be interesting to have either, I guess.
But the low bound, if you don't know where it's not.
That's a good
thing.
Well, let's do the only get for another way. Yes. I think this works.
Okay. Now, you know, the second tail, what else is entanglement good for? It's good for quantum metrology, okay? I just made these slides between yesterday and today, so I might fumble around a little bit, but please interrupt me and continue to ask questions. Hopefully I'll sort it out if I don't say it correctly.
What's the coupling constant?
The coupling constant, so H is your Hamiltonian. H naught is a dimensionless Hamiltonian, and gamma is a parameter. So if you have a Hamiltonian for a spin, you might... The Hamiltonian operator would be sigma z, and this would be h bar omega.
So it's the biggest, largest eigenvalue, basically.
No, it's. I mean, it's system dependent. Oh, it's a frequency,
right,
for example.
All right, okay,
so it's an unknown parameter.
All right.
Okay.
All
right. Okay. Okay, so what's the goal? The goal is to take such a Hamiltonian that depends on some parameter, right? And this gamma could be a function of some other parameter of interest. For example, gamma could be, like I said, h bar omega. You really want to, you know, we already know h bar, say. We really want to find omega, but if we can estimate gamma, we can find omega from classical estimation theory. So, I mean, assuming it's not like 2 to the 2, or some crazy function. You know, I don't consider that a possibility. So without lots of generality, I'm just going to consider gamma just sitting in front there. Okay. We want to estimate this. So how does one do this? Well, what you do is you take a quantum system, and you evolve it according to this Hamiltonian for some time t, and then you measure it, and you extract information about it. Okay. And typically, almost all the previous literature on this focuses on Hamiltonians of the form, of this form. So this is, you know, you can think of this as a free Hamiltonian on some spins, right, that aren't interacting, okay? And so if you put in separable input states, okay, then the so-called shot noise limit, which is routinely achieved in, for example, Ramsey interferometry, you get the optimal scaling here. So delta gamma here is the standard deviation in our estimator for gamma. Okay, so we've got some estimator. Turns out it doesn't matter if it's biased or unbiased. We're just looking at the standard deviation here. And it scales like this. Here, this is a semi-norm. This is the spectral difference between the largest and the smallest eigenvalue here in one of these HJs. Okay? So this is the bound here. And this is asymptotically achievable for many trials. I've suppressed the dependence on the number of trials because that's only sort of a statistical improvement. So rather than muddy the discussion, I'm just going to suppress those statistical factors. Okay? Okay, so what is some entanglement value? Well, it turns out if you gather up several systems while keeping the number of total things that you've done constant, right? The total number of measurements, these statistical factors, you keep that constant, but you bunch up some of your measurements into states, which into probes, which you then can prepare in an entangled state, not a separable state. And then you feed this in to that Hamiltonian, then you're getting global contributions from that Hamiltonian on all of these eigenvalues at once here. And you pick up a quadratic improvement. So back here I had a root n down here, and now I've got an n down here in the denominator, and this is still the spectral gap, if you will, across one of these Hamiltonians. Okay. So this was shown in this nice paper here by Giovannetti, Lloyd, and Marconi. It was shown for this case that this is optimal. Okay, so this is the best scaling you're going to hope to get in something like this. Okay, so can we do better than this? Okay, their derivation depends on several assumptions. Okay, first of it depends on the nature of the coupling Hamiltonian, that it has this simple form with non-interacting things. It depends somewhat subtly on the role of ancillas. They use discrete time dynamics. Okay, and they don't allow auxiliary Hamiltonians while evolving under the coupling Hamiltonian. Okay, so we're going to violate these assumptions now, and we're going to try and do better than this. Okay. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to consider now fully continuous time dynamics now. So what we have is we have an H naught here I'll mention this decomposition here in a second, but for now just ignore it. So what we have is here, we have the Hamiltonian here with the one parameter Hamiltonian, whose parameter we're trying to estimate. And then we have an arbitrary time-dependent Hamiltonian, okay? And I'm making no assumptions about this whatsoever. This thing can couple to ancillas. It can do feedback. I can do deferred measurements and feedback control on the results of those measurements, and change things. The only thing that's important here is that this is not coupled to the parameter. Okay, so this is completely independent, but it's completely arbitrary as well. So this can entangle up the probes and the ancillas as much as you like. Okay, or it could intercouple the probes as well in ways that are not coupled to the parameter. All of that is completely arbitrary. Okay? So I'm going to consider later in the talk, the next few slides, I'm going to leave H not arbitrary, but a little later I'm going to specialize to this form of H not. And what I call this is a symmetric coupling. Okay? So this is a K-body Hamiltonian, all right? And it symmetrically couples all k things. So for example, in the two-body case, this would be every possible pair of particles couples, and the J1, J2 particle couples with Hamiltonian HJ1, HJ2, and so on, okay? It's going to be symmetric when I just say that it's the same term for each pair, but I'm not going to make this assumption yet. I'm going to push that to the end. Okay. So the strategy here is we're first going to bound this in terms of this arbitrary H naught, and then we're going to plug in some special forms and see what kind of scaling we get out. Okay. Now, Michela? Okay, who pointed out to me at lunch when he asked me about this that I'm not, there are certain black box lower bounds here that one might invoke, which are essentially the Heisenberg limit. I'm not breaking any of these bounds, right? These are theorems. What I'm essentially going to be doing here is trading off depth for breadth. And that statement will, it's maybe a little out of context now, but hopefully it'll become more clear in the next few slides. Okay, so so we have some initial state runoff, okay, and now we're going to time evolve it. So what's I didn't list it here, but mu gamma of t is just the unitary which we get by this Hamiltonian dynamics here from our Hamiltonian H sub gamma. Okay? So this is our time evolved rho. And of course, this is, you know, the equation that the unitary obeys here. And this is our Hamiltonian. Okay, our H bar is 1. So some stuff from quantum information theory. There's these nice references here, Holbaum and Hellstrom, and also this nice paper by Bronson and Caves, where they derive this quantum Kramer-Rao bound. Okay, so classically, the Kramer-Rao bound is a bound on an estimator. So this is the variance of the estimator. So there should be parentheses around this. This is delta gamma squared. Okay. Is greater than or equal to, so 1 over the so-called Fisher information, right? And what's the Fisher information? Well, in the quantum context, it's just the expectation value of the square of this operator L, okay? This operator L is implicitly defined by this equation here on the left-hand side, okay? So it's the solution to this equation. I differentiate rho sub gamma with respect to the parameter I'm trying to estimate, and then I solve for L. Okay, and I can similarly, as I did with you, I can write down an evolution equation. You know, K generates translations in gamma, so partial rho gamma satisfies this equation over here on the right, where gamma is this operator here in terms of U, or sorry, K is this operator here in terms of U. Okay, so the next step. And if I eliminate that arbitrary time-dependent Hamiltonian, then I recover the fact that that K is just, you know, T times H naught. Okay, so this makes sense. So the next step, I'm going to relate L to K over here. I mean, we see it's already related, but I'm going to get a nicer relationship between them here in a second. And then I'm going to plug it into this Fisher information, and I'm going to use it as a bound here to bound this estimator. Okay. Okay, so for pure states, I can take, let me go back to that previous slide. I can use the fact that for pure states, rho squared equals rho. And I can differentiate this. And when I do that, I get partial rho partial gamma equals partial rho squared partial gamma. And then I just use the product rule, right? And I find that L is just proportional to partial rho partial gamma. Okay? So this, for pure states, this is what L is. Okay? And so from the equations on the previous page, I can just substitute in this form here in terms of the commutator, the generator of the generator of realgebra here, the generator of translations of gamma. I can just substitute that in for partial rho partial gamma, and I get this relationship here between L and K. Okay? Now I can plug this back into the Fisher information, okay? And I get this chain of inequalities here. Okay? So it turns out if I calculate the expectation, if I square this for L, I square this commutator, and then I take its expectation value here, it turns out that for pure states I get exactly this. I get twice the standard deviation in K as an operator. Okay? I'm not going to do that. It's pretty straightforward. For pure states, these are equalities. Okay? These two things here. All right? So 1 over the standard deviation is exactly this for pure states. If you go back to the Bronson Caves reference, they show that it's an inequality for mixed states. So I really need only consider pure states, okay? And then I can go a step further, and I can put it in terms of the semi-norm here of the operator K. This variance is bounded by the semi-norm, right? Intuitively, I have some operator. It's got a maximum and a minimum eigenvalue. I want to bound its variance. How can I maximize its variance? Well, put in a cat state, a superposition of the smallest and largest eigenvalue. Well, that's just what this semi-norm is, right? And you can rigorously show that that's a bound on the variance. Okay? So, yeah, this is just the definition of the operator semi-norm. Okay. And don't be scared off by the term semi-norm. It behaves in almost every aspect like a norm. It obeys the triangle inequality. It's unitarily invariant.
So what's the difference?
The only difference is that a vanishing semi-norm does not imply that the argument is zero. So for example, any scalar matrix has a vanishing semi-norm. In fact, those are the only things that have vanishing semi-norm besides, well, zeros of the scalar matrix. But those are the only things. It's got a kernel in some sense, right? So that's the only thing. And I mean, scalar matrices are not interesting anyway in terms of Hamiltonians, because they don't generate any dynamics, right? So it's kind of a trivial point. In fact, you know, one can just imagine that this minimum eigenvalue has been set to zero, and the largest has been appropriately raised. You know, you can just rescale things that way if you don't like the prefix semi in front of your norms.
Just modding out or something, doesn't matter anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So this is a neat little trick that we can use to get away with this in the continuous time case. I'm gonna time evolve the operator k with the time evolution operator for rho. Okay? So remember, k is the generator of translations in gamma. Okay, so I'm gonna define this new operator f, which is a time evolved k. Okay? And you know, you plug in the form for k and you get this over here in terms of u. You can show, it's pretty simple to show, just using what we know about u and this equation, to show that partial f partial t obeys this equation. Okay? Now we're in business, because we've related f to h naught, and there's some boundary conditions on f. So we can integrate this equation. Okay? There's a constant of integration, which you know, may depend on gamma, but it actually turns out to be zero because of the boundary conditions, so we just ignore it. So we integrate this equation, and we get an expression for f, okay, over here in terms of h naught. And then we just, you know, bring these u's back over, and we get an expression for k in terms of h naught, and that's this expression down here. Okay, and this is an integral, and you can see where we pulled in the extra u's here and here. Okay, so the next step now is we want to bound this, so I'm going to take the norm of both sides and use the triangle inequality and the unitarian invariance that I just mentioned here. And so norm of k is just, you know, triangle inequality, pull the norm inside the integral. You know, forget about these u's, it's unitarily invariant. And then the h naught is just a constant. H naught doesn't depend on time. So that comes out of the integral, I just do the integral and I just get this. So k is bounded above by the amount of time by which I evolve times the semi-norm here of our coupling Hamiltonian, our one-parameter Hamiltonian that we're interested in. Okay? And so recall that there's no auxiliary Hamiltonian, k is just this. And so, you know, in that case, we saturate this bound. Okay, so I've just given you a sequence of inequalities with, and I've shown that at each step they can be saturated as well. So these are tight, at least for some situations. Okay? So this is achievable, right? So up till now, what I've shown is that this standard deviation here is bounded above by 1 over the time, the evolution time, times the semi-norm of the coupling Hamiltonian, and that this is achievable. Okay? I've shown all that. Okay? And this is a fully general bound. Okay? This included, remember, the Hamiltonian h of t. I made no assumptions about that whatsoever. This could include feedback, oscillas, etc. Okay, so now we get to the interesting part. Okay, we're going to plug in a special form for h naught. We're going to assume that it's separable in this sense here. So it's a tensor product of Hamiltonians on, you know, system J1, LF through system JK. And then we're going to assume that it's independent, that it's the same one for each pair. Okay, so that's what I mean by k-body, symmetric, and separable. Okay, here just means it's a k-body Hamiltonian. Okay, again, I'm going to use the triangle inequality. Okay, and then how many terms are in there? Well, there's just n choose k. And how does it scale? It scales like n to the k, you know, up to some k factorial term. We don't expect k is going to get so big that matters too much. But, and this is saturatable again if, for example, I choose, you know, a z, 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 z coupling. for example, I can saturate this triangular inequality as well. So so this is a new metrological limit, right? Although when you take the I didn't write it out, when you take the semi-norm of this, you know, for the particular case of z, you know, I can bound it by this on the semi-norm if it's separable like this. So here's a new metrological limit. And now maybe it's a little more clear what I meant by this depth versus breadth trade-off thing. All I've done was essentially speed up time, right? I put in a whole bunch more terms into my Hamiltonian, and the dynamics just happened that much faster, right? I'm essentially turning up the energy, and so I'm getting more time faster. But you know, to the experimentalist, if one could do this, you know, this is a big deal, right? To the computer scientist, it's sort of, well, okay, all you did was trade off some things, but to the experimentalist, you know, this is an important trade-off.
It's not trivial for computer science. You can't always trade space and time.
Okay. So, well, in this particular case, it works out that way, and so, okay. Yeah. So, all right. So now, I'm going to speculate a little bit.
Speculation as a reference?
No, it's an environment in my tech. Which I'm going to enter into in a minute. And I have some reason to believe that this isn't just nonsense, but I hope I can appropriately qualify this. And by all means, please be as critical as you can. So what I've shown is that there's this new metrological limit here. And in particular, the most realistic case that we might be able to get take advantage of this result is for the case of two-body couplings, right? So in that case, we're going to get an additional quadratic speed up over the standard quantum limit. So then we get, you know, 1 over n over the Heisenberg limit. So we have a 1 over n squared scaling now, and this additional little boost here in the norm. So the question I'm going to ask now is this physical, right? Certainly two-body couplings are physical. I don't think anyone disputes that. However, in order to take advantage of this, I summed over all possible pairs of particles. Okay? So I'm sort of assuming spatially non-local Hamiltonians. Okay, so now begin the speculation which I didn't want to actually put in writing on any of these slides. So I have this paper which will be appearing on QuantPH in the next week or two. And I've been away, so I've been only able to correspond with my co-authors by email. But my co-author, who is an experimentalist, so he has some credentials, he claims that there are Hamiltonians for which it may be possible to actually implement this. So and he cites this in the most recent draft of our paper. This is the paper that he cites as being particularly promising. There's a Hamiltonian in this paper. You can look it up. I've only barely looked at it myself at this point. But you know, if this is true, then this is pretty exciting, because achieving an additional quadratic speed up here may allow us to do even better precision measurements, even better metrology. This is speculative, but you know, hopefully this is true. Okay, so what did I talk about today? So we saw today that, you know, vanishingly small amounts of entanglement in this sense, in terms of this negativity, they can still lead to an exponential speed up, apparently. And there appears to be this discontinuity, a pretty big discontinuity actually, between what you can get with zero entanglement, none whatsoever, and what you can get with non-zero entanglement. Okay, pretty interesting. However, we can have really highly entangled ancilla states. We can do feedback. We can do whatever we want, any sort of coupling we want that's not coupled to a parameter, and it won't get you anything in quantum metrology. But you do get, you know, you do get the additional speedups from the cat state. So you get some entanglement does buy you something in this case. Non-nearest neighbor, I didn't want to say non-nearest neighbor, because that would imply that the couplings are only you can't couple with your neighbor, only with your non-nearest neighbor. So non-nearest neighbor Valentonians lead to quadratic or better improvements in metrological precision. So I don't know how physical this is. Current theory is not pessimistic, and some people, namely me and my co-author, J.M. Jeremiah, we're optimistic. So, and with that, here are the paper for the first half of the talk, and this paper here will appear on quantification in the next week or two. Thanks.
So I'm trying to think about whether you could prove an oracle separation between, say, classical computing and quantum computing with one clean qubit, right? The question is, what does it mean to take a computer with one clean qubit and give it an oracle?
Yeah, you have a classical computer
too. Okay, so you also have a classical, yeah, but then the question stands. Because, we'd like to somehow give this quantum computer with one clean qubit an oracle.
Yeah, but you could give it a classical oracle and have a classical computer control inputs to the quantum.
Right, so it's like we have some oracle, but then as soon as you write the output to the oracle, that output part gets immediately measured.
Because
we need like a classical oracle which is accessed by a quantum machine, right? Otherwise, you could just use the oracle to simulate a general quantum computer, which, and sneak it in that way. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you could compare classical. You want to compare purely classical computer with the oracle versus purely classical computer with the oracle and the.
One clean qubit, yeah. I want some complexity theoretic evidence that one,
That one is different.
That one clean qubit is better than.
There was a paper in the last couple of months that came out that talks about the computational complexity of the DQC1 model. I haven't read it because I'm not very conversant in.
Okay, I think I saw the paper. It is proving like different inclusions and stuff. It's not what I'm asking for yet.
Okay.
What it do is it's a diagonal matrix, and then it just has plus one and minus one from the diagonal, and that sort of corresponds to a classical oracle where the information is in the phase.
Yeah.
In that case, it's easy to get the trace because you just pick random elements and you look at that, right?
Yeah, I guess
you
can do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And it just looked like a classical sampling
problem.
So what exactly is the justification for the second statement that you made in the accelerator?
The fact that when I turn that polarization down, arbitrarily small but fixed. Okay, so recall that if I do this many measurements, or if I run that circuit this many times, then I'm going to get the trace for arbitrarily large n. Right, so I can make this thing very small but fixed, arbitrarily close to zero in fact, but then fix it and I'll still get a speed up.
So it's meant to be a thing that's sort of relative to this particular model. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you should change your summary by saying instead of can still read, appears to be.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
So a question about your statement that when you say a cat state is necessary to beat the standard quantum limit, are you really assuming qubits? Because because a single mode cat state beats the quantum limit and yet it's not entangled.
Well, first of all, a cat state is sufficient. There could be other states which could achieve better scaling. So I probably missaid that. And I'm not assuming anything about qubits either. All I care about is the separation between the maximum and the minimum. I mean, I'm just sort of making the cat state sort of energetically as far apart as possible, superposition of the the two most energetic.
I know what you mean. I mean, one of the issues that we've been finding recently is you've actually got to compare the whole team. Just looking at this N or N factor in front can be misleading because the state, one of the common states that people have been thinking about is, say, a superposition of 0 plus N. Take a superposition of the vacuum state plus a number state N. That will lead you to a Heisenberg limited measurement with your 1 over N type of scaling. That comes because of the separation of the eigenvalues.
Yeah, well, that's going to go into the semi-norm part of it, and not in the repeated application of measurements.
Exactly.
Right?
So that's why when you start thinking about physical applications, you've actually got to think, which part do I put it? You've got to think of the entire term rather than just looking at the term at the front.
Sure. I mean, I guess what we're imagining here is that for any particular experimental setup and parameter that you want to estimate, that seminorm is fixed. I'm not considering as much the scaling in the seminorm. So I'm imagining, you know, atoms in a trap, maybe a BEC or something like that, where experimenters are actively trying to pack more and more atoms into these things. But, you know, your laser frequency is fixed or something. So you have some fixed spacing, level spacing that you have to work with. That's sort of what I'm imagining here when I talk about scaling.
Okay, that's what I see.